Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1076, Surveillance Valley Part 2, subtitled Mauthausen on Our Mind. This is being recorded on June 25th of the year 2019. This series talking about the development of the internet and related technologies and the applications of those centers around a consummately important book that I will begin excerpting in this program, which will form the foundation and much of the substantive discussion in weeks to come. That book is called Surveillance Valley. It was authored by Yasha, Y-A-S-H-A, Levine, capital L-E-V-I-N-E. It is as important a book as I have ever read. I will state without qualification that I have never read a more important book. And beyond that, I really think it will be impossible for the average person to understand the world in which he or she lives, particularly younger people who've grown up with the internet, with mobile technology, with social media, with apps up the yin-yang that make people's lives completely transparent to any one of a number of institutions. It would be impossible, I would say, for them to fully comprehend the nature of the world in which they live without reading this book. Again, Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. I should stress that I get no money whatsoever from this. This is simply being done, really out of interest for our civilization and the future of humankind itself. I guess you could say I'm only in it for the karma. In my last show, we accessed an article from the 01 blog of April 28th, 2018, by Yasha Levine, the author of Surveillance Valley. It's called The Racist Origins of America's Tech Industry, and it talks about the development of the census, the development of Herman Hollerith's tabulating machines, early forerunners of the computers that we now use, and of how it, that is to say, that technology was used for eugenics purposes, how the census was manipulated for political and eugenics purposes. And then in the conclusion to that essay, Yasha Levine talks about how Herman Hollerith's machines, which were bought out by, the right to which was purchased by, and they were developed by IBM, figured in a decisive way in Nazi Germany. We're going to pick up with that narrative at this point, again from the 01 blog of April 28th of 2018, The Racist Origins of America's Tech Industry, this by Yasha Levine. Hollerith tabulators were a big hit all over the world, but one country was particularly enamored with them. Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler came to power on the back of the economic devastation that followed Germany's defeat in World War I. To Hitler, however, the problem plaguing Germany was not economic or political, it was racial. As he put it in Mein Kampf, the state is a racial organism and not an economic organization, unquote. The reason Germany had fallen so far, he argued, was its failure to tend to its racial purity. There were only about 500,000 Jews in Germany in 1933, less than 1% of the population, but he singled them out as the root cause of all the nation's problems. Hitler and the Nazis drew much of their inspiration from the U.S. eugenics movement and the system of institutional racism that had arisen in slavery's wake. Their solution was to isolate the so-called mongrels, then continuously monitor the racial purity of the German people to keep the folk free of further contamination. The only problem? How to tell who is really pure and who is not. The U.S. had a ready solution. IBM's German subsidiary landed its first major contract the same year Hitler became chancellor. The 1933 Nazi census was pushed through by Hitler as an emergency genetic stocktaking of the German people. Along with numerous other data points, the census focused on collecting fertility data for German women, particularly women of good Aryan stock. Also included in the census was a special count of religiously observant Jews or Glaubensjuden. Nazi officials wanted the entire count, estimated to be about 65 million people, to be done in just 4 months. It was a monumental task, and German IBM officials worked around the clock to finish it. So important was the success of the contract to IBM that CEO Thomas J. Watson personally toured the giant Berlin warehouse where hundreds of female clerks worked in rotating 7-hour shifts, 24 hours a day. Watson came away greatly impressed with the work of his German managers. They had pulled off a seemingly impossible assignment, one that was complicated by a custom-enlarged punch card format necessary for, quote, political considerations, unquote. IBM's coded explanation for the extra data demands the Nazi regime required. As Hitler's Nazi Party tightened its grip on Germany, it launched all sorts of additional data-gathering programs to purify the German nation, and IBM helped them do it. The precondition for every deportation was accurate knowledge of how many Jews in a particular district fitted the racial and demographic descriptions in Berlin's quotas, write David Martin Lübke and Sybil Milton in, quote, Locating the Victim, unquote, a study into Nazi use of the tabulator machines. Armed with these data, they said, the Gestapo often proved able to anticipate with remarkable accuracy the total number of deportees for each racial, status, and age category, unquote. Germany's vast state bureaucracy and its military and rearmament programs, including the country's growing concentration camp slave labor system, also required data processing services. By the time the U.S. officially entered the war in 1941, IBM's German subsidiary had grown to employ 10,000 people and served 300 different German government agencies. The Nazi Party Treasury, the SS, the War Ministry, the Reichsbank, the Reichspost, the Armaments Ministry, the Navy, Army, and Air Force, and the Reich Statistical Office, the list of IBM's clients went on and on. This history reveals an uncomfortable and fundamental truth about computer technology. Quote, indeed, the Third Reich would open startling statistical venues for Hollerith machines, never before instituted, perhaps never before even imagined, unquote, wrote Edwin Black in IBM and the Holocaust, his pioneering 2001 expose of the forgotten business ties between IBM and Nazi Germany. In Hitler's Germany, the statistical and census community, overrun with doctrinaire Nazis, publicly boasted about the new demographic breakthroughs their equipment would achieve, unquote. The last sentence again. In Hitler's Germany, the statistical and census community, overrun with doctrinaire Nazis, publicly boasted about the new demographic breakthroughs their equipment would achieve. Demand for Hollerith tabulators was so robust that IBM was forced to open a new factory in Berlin to crank out all the new machines. At the facility's christening ceremony, which was attended by a top U.S. IBM executive and the elite of the Nazi Party, the head of IBM's German subsidiary, gave a rousing speech about the important role that Hollerith tabulations played in Hitler's drive to purify Germany and cleanse it of inferior racial stock. Quote, "We are very much like the physician in that we dissect, cell by cell, the German cultural body," he said, again quoting. "We report every individual characteristic on a little card. These are not dead cards, quite to the contrary. They prove later on that they come to life when the cards are sorted at a rate of 25,000 per hour according to certain characteristics. These characteristics are grouped like the organs of our cultural body, and they will be calculated and determined with the help of our tabulating machine," unquote. On the surface, it may seem like the story of Hermann Hollerith and the U.S. Census are historical relics, an echo from a bygone era. But this history reveals an uncomfortable and fundamental truth about computer technology. We can thank nativism and the census for helping to bring the computer age into existence in the first place. And as the battle over the 2020 census makes clear, the drive to tally up our neighbors, to sort them into categories, and turn them into statistics still carries the seed of our own dehumanization. Boy, doesn't it? And an excerpt from that selfsame blog article from, again, 01-428-2018, The Racist Origins of America's Tech Industry by Yasha Levine. Based about the U.S. Census and the changes that the Trump administration has proposed, based on a close reading of internal Department of Commerce documents tied to the census citizen question proposal, it appears that the Trump administration wants to use the census to construct a first-of-its-kind citizenship registry for the entire U.S. population, a decision that arguably exceeds the legal authority of the census. Quote, "It was deep in the documentation that was released," unquote, Robert Groves, a former Census Bureau director who headed the National Academy's committee convened to investigate the 2020 census, told me by telephone, quote, "No one picked up on it much, but the term registry," unquote, "in our world means not a collection of data for statistical purposes, but rather to know the identity of particular people in order to use that knowledge to affect their lives," unquote. Given the administration's posture toward immigration, the fact that it wants to build a comprehensive citizenship database is highly concerning. To Groves, it clearly signals a bright line being crossed. Well, indeed. In the conclusion, I think that speaks for itself. Are we headed down the same road that Nazi Germany went down? Well, I would argue yes, in many respects. However, the technology has changed, or changed some of the basics of this. And in that regard, in the conclusion, the postscript to Surveillance Valley, Yasha Levine muses about the Mauthausen concentration camp in the Mybillig rural area of Austria. From the conclusion, but in the 1930s, Mauthausen had been a vital economic engine of Hitler's genocidal plan to remake Europe and the Soviet Union into his own backyard utopia. It started out as a granite quarry, but quickly grew into the largest slave labor complex in Nazi Germany, with 50 subcamps that span most of modern-day Austria. Here, hundreds of thousands of prisoners, mostly European Jews, but also Roma, Spaniards, Russians, Serbs, Slovenes, Germans, Bulgarians, even Cubans, were worked to death. Because I would add political prisoners, ideological opponents of the Nazis, and also gays and others were among those fed into the lethal slave labor pool, continuing, of those slaves. They refined oil, built fighter aircraft, assembled cannons, developed rocket technology, and were leased out to private German businesses. Volkswagen, Siemens, Daimler-Benz, BMW, Bosch all benefited from the camp's slave labor pool. Mauthausen, the administration's nerve center, was centrally directed from Berlin using the latest in early computer technology, IBM punch card tabulators. And Mauthausen, in turn, was one of the computerized nerve centers, or IBM punch card tabulator nerve centers, of the entire Third Reich slave labor slash industrial system. Joshua Levine writes, the camp had several IBM machines working overtime to handle the big churn of inmates and to make sure there were always enough bodies to perform the necessary work. These machines did not operate in isolation, but rather were part of a larger slave labor control and accounting system that stretched across Nazi-occupied Europe, connecting Berlin to every major concentration and labor punch card, telegraph, telephone, and human courier. This wasn't the automated type of computer network system that the Pentagon would begin to build in the U.S. just a decade later, but it was an information network nonetheless, an electromechanical web that fueled and sustained Nazi Germany's war machine with blazing efficiency. It extended beyond the labor camps and reached into the cities and towns, crunching mountains of genealogical data to track down people with even the barest whiff of Jewish blood or perceived racial impurity in a mad rush to fulfill Adolf Hitler's drive to purify the German people. But they made the Nazi death machine run faster and more efficiently, scouring the population and tracking down victims in ways that would never have been possible without them. Indeed, and bear in mind that the changes that the Trump administration has proposed for the U.S. 2020 census may very well lead to something similar in the U.S. Now, that was from the postscript to Yasha Levine's Surveillance Valley. We're going to enter into more of the actual text of the book. However, we are going to digress somewhat. Again, I have emphasized that this book, again, Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine, is as important a book as I have ever read. I've never read a more important book. I don't think a more important book has ever been written. It's also remarkable in that it is not very long. I get no money from this. I would go so far as to say that unless you are, well, blessedly positioned, to coin the term, you really or one cannot fully understand the world in which you live until you have read this book. Now, the Internet. Much of the book, much of the first half of the book, talks about the incremental development of the Internet from a series of programs that the Pentagon put into realization under the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. What is not generally known is that the genesis of the Internet was part of a series of overlapping DARPA projects that also gave rise to Agent Orange. That was the devastating dioxin-laden herbicide, which was, along with other similarly coded agents, were sprayed all over what was then South Vietnam under the auspices of Operation Ranch Hand. That was the code name for the operation. The results were not only to defoliate much of the left Vietnamese landscape, but the dioxin has produced an epidemic of cancers and birth defects, and not just among the Vietnamese. American GIs have returned home with the same problems, epidemic of cancer, birth defects, and other things from Agent Orange, from Operation Ranch Hand. and Agent Orange and Operation Ranch Hand and the Internet have an overlapping genesis. And the raison d'etre for the Internet is not as a wonderful communication device that will make convenient products accessible to you overnight, and you can watch your favorite movies and television programs and use your apps to stay in touch with everybody and Facebook and social media to do all that wonderful stuff. The focal point of the Internet, the foundational genesis of the Internet, was counterinsurgency. The Internet is a weapon. It is an information weapon. It is not for recreation. It is not for communication. It is a weapon. And some of the basic points that Yasha Levine makes in the book and that we will go into, the harvesting of data by the intelligence services, which really was known before, but which emerged into the limelight courtesy of Eddie Snowden, a double agent, as we will see, that harvesting of data by intelligence services is precisely what the Internet was designed to do in the first place. The harvesting of data engaged in by the major tech corporations is an extension of the data gathering surveillance that was and is the raison d'etre for the Internet in the first place. The big tech companies all collaborate with the various intelligence agencies that they publicly scorn and seek to ostensibly distance themselves from. Privacy advocates like Edward Snowden, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Jacob Applebaum, and WikiLeaks are complicit in the very data harvesting and surveillance that they publicly decry. Snowden and other privacy activists are actually double agents, consciously channeling people fearful of having their communications monitored into technologies that will facilitate that very surveillance. Again, the Internet is not a wonderful communication medium. It is not a convenience. It is not in and of itself a good thing, although it has some good aspects to it. It is, of course, now a way of life around the world. The Internet is a weapon. It is an information weapon generated for the purposes of counterinsurgency. From Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. In the 1960s, America was a global power overseeing an increasingly volatile world. Conflicts and regional insurgencies against U.S. allied governments from South America to Southeast Asia and the Middle East. These were not traditional wars that involved big armies, but guerrilla campaigns and local rebellions, frequently fought in regions where Americans had little previous experience. Who were these people? Why were they rebelling? What could be done to stop them? In military circles, it was believed that these questions were of vital importance to America's pacification efforts, and some argued that the only effective way to answer them was to develop and leverage computer-aided information technology. The Internet came out of this effort, an attempt to build computer systems that could collect and share intelligence, watch the world in real time, and study and analyze people and political movements with the ultimate goal of predicting and preventing social upheaval. And about Operation Ranch Hand and the spraying of herbicides with the results that I have indicated. Operation Ranch Hand was merciless and it is a clear violation of the Geneva Conventions. It remains one of the most shameful episodes of the Vietnam War, yet the defoliation project is notable for more than just its unimaginable cruelty. The government body at its lead was a Department of Defense outfit called the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, born in 1958 as a cash program to project the U.S. to protect the U.S. from a Soviet nuclear threat from space. It launched several groundbreaking initiatives tasked with developing advanced weapons and military technologies. Among them were Project Agile and Command and Control Research, two overlapping ARPA initiatives that created the Internet. And that also created Agent Orange. Before continuing with Surveillance Valley per se, We're going to go back to Miscellaneous Archive Show number 5, recorded in the spring of 1984, and we are going to listen to how the origins of Nazism itself and the Nazi Party itself were basically inextricably linked with counterinsurgency. World War I ended with a large-scale socialist slash communist rebellion in key cities in Germany, Munich among them. This was met with a wave of political assassinations by underground units of the German army, the so-called Black Reichswehr, and it was against the background of that assassination program, not just of communists and Marxists, but also of relatively conservative social democrats like Walter von Rathenau, that led to the genesis of the Nazi Party. From Miscellaneous Archive Show M5 from the spring of 1984.
Of Rome's pivotal role in forming the Femic organizations of the Black Reichswehr and the Freikorps, Conrad Haydn writes as follows in Der Führer. This Rome, more than any other in his circle, is the key figure we were seeking when we asked, who sent out the murderers? Who gave the judges their orders? A young officer in his mid-30s, a captain like a thousand others, the kind who might gladly and easily disappear in the mass, he stood modestly aside in the dazzling parades where generals and marshals, personally responsible, perhaps, for the loss of the war, were applauded by a misguided patriotic youth. Rome was only an adjutant to the chief of the infantry troops stationed in Bavaria, a certain Colonel von Epp. But from this modest post, he established, in defiance of the law and against the will of every minister in Berlin and Munich, a volunteer army of 100,000 men, calling themselves modestly the Einwohnerwehr, the citizens' defense. When this armed mass was finally disbanded by orders from above, he formed a new nuclei. New organizations kept springing up with all sorts of names under constantly changing official leaders, all having ostensibly nothing to do with the Reichswehr. Actually, all were an extension of the Reichswehr under the command of Rome. Very important to remember, as we saw last time, that the Freikorps, the Black Reichswehr, the FEMA were extensions of the German army operating in defiance of the civilian authority in Weimar Germany. The next point that Conrad Haydn goes on to make here that we're going to cover concerns the cooperation of certain elements of the Allied occupation force in Germany. Many of these so-called control commissions were sympathetic to the positions of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr because they feared the possibility of revolution in Germany, and so they actively took part in seeing to it that these underground German army organizations got the armaments that were left over from World War I. Haydn describes this as follows. A gigantic arsenal had been left behind by the fallen German army. In the peace treaty, Germany had promised to destroy it. The Allies supervised the process by control commissions, sitting in the large cities of Germany and traveling throughout the country. These arms had to be saved. In Bavaria, Rome undertook this task. He was able to persuade a few of the Allied officers that these old armored cars and rusty machine guns could be of no use in serious warfare, but would come in handy for combating the world revolution which was moving through Germany toward the Rhine. This strange collaboration with the Allied organs must have been very close. In his memoirs, Rome indicates as much in passing, praising certain British officers and mentioning an Italian, Major Gramaccini, last name G-R-A-M-M-A-C-I-N-I. Now, the next thing that Haydn goes on to describe here is the fact that Ernst Röhm basically was the key man who formed the German Nazi Party. Now, this was the German Nazi Party, that is, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, basically grew out of a defunct political party. Now, the key figure, again, with the formation of the German Nazi Party was Ernst Röhm. And it's important to note a couple of things here. First of all, that in its inception, the German Nazi Party was nothing more than a front for German military intelligence. The German Nazi Party was basically a vehicle for introducing the German army into civilian life for the purposes of fomenting political reaction and eventually promoting a political situation in Germany favorable to the realization of the long-standing dream of German generals and industrialists of world conquest, okay? But remember, in its inception, the German Nazi Party was nothing more than a front for German military intelligence. And it's worth noting that the same person who, according to Haydn, was the key figure with regard to the formation of the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr, and to all appearances the liaison officer between the regular German general staff and these so-called Freikorps, these so-called underground organizations, again, actually an extension of the German army, was Ernst Röhm. He then becomes the founder of the German Nazi Party, and after the Nazi Party was founded, Ernst Röhm became the head of the SA, the Sturmabteilung, who were the brown shirts. These were the fellows who actually went out into the streets of Weimar, Germany, and through force of arms, basically conquered all of their opponents by either driving them underground or killing them outright, okay? And as Haydn points out in the passage I'm about to read, entire companies of the supposedly demobilized German army were turned out in the ranks of the Sturmabteilung, the brown shirts, up to company strength, okay? Haydn writes as follows, in der Führer of the founding of the Nazi Party. Röhm founded the National Socialist German Workers' Party. It might be said to have existed before him under the simpler name of the German Workers' Party. But that was a club, sitting in the back rooms of little restaurants, talking. At all events, a mere idea. And an idea it remained until the club, seeking to win over the German workers, became the party of soldiers. This was Röhm's work. He discovered the club, joined it, an officer among workers, and not he alone. With commands, he forced his soldiers. With pleas, he drove his comrades into it. Thus, the party became a political troop. Whole Reichswehr companies marched through the streets in civilian clothes as National Socialists. Thus arose the formation which later, as the SA, became the basic party formation. So again, not to belabor the point, the German Nazi Party in its inception, a front for German military intelligence, the supposedly demobilized German army simply being turned out in the ranks of the stormtroopers, the brown shirts. Now, where does Adolf Hitler fit into this whole business? Basically, Adolf Hitler, just like Ernst Röhm, was an underground, intelligence agent for the German army during this revolutionary period. Now, jumping back in time just a little bit, Hitler's first assignment as an undercover German army intelligence agent was to infiltrate the unsuccessful German revolution in the Munich area and betray it. And this he did quite effectively. Basically, he was a stool pigeon. Haydn writes about this in Der Führer as follows. When the white troops, that's the reactionary troops, when the white troops entered Munich, they went to the 19th Infantry Barracks and found a body of soldiers which an eyewitness later called a wild red rabble, unquote. Every 10th man chosen at random was stood up against the wall and shot. Only one was set aside from the very first to be spared. His position was only too clear. When the high officers of the Munich Reichswehr fled before the radical uprising, they had left this man behind to observe and report. A dangerous commission requiring courage, but ugly. A few months previous, this man had attracted the attention of his officers in a strange way. They all noticed him, one of them later recollected, because his salutes were so punctilious as to be provocative in those revolutionary months when most of the soldiers defiantly refrained from saluting at all. When the government troops stormed Munich, his comrades wanted to help defend the city. He made a speech dissuading them. His comrades had suspected him of being a spy, and during the Soviet regime he barely escaped arrest. Now he became the executioner. After May 2nd, an examining commission sent hundreds of men to the slaughterhouse wall. This man soon came to the attention of the commission, which used him as an informer. He delivered his reports in writing and later boasted of them. When he was ordered before the examining commission, wrote one of his friends, his indictments cast a merciless clarity upon the unspeakable disgrace of the military treason practiced by the Jewish dictatorship of Munich's Soviet period, unquote. By rank, this stool pigeon was a corporal. By nationality, strange to say, an Austrian. His stated profession was painter and architect. His name was Adolf Hitler.
That began from the spring of 1984. By the way, the book from which that material was taken is Der Führer by Konrad K-O-N-R-A-D Haydn, H-E-I-B-A-N. It was a bestseller in this country in 1943. Again, Der Führer by Konrad Haydn. We're going to listen to some material from Who Financed Hitler by James and Suzanne Poole about Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. This will be important. We are going to consider both the material from Miscellaneous Archive Show M5 and this in connection with not only the genesis of the Internet as a counterinsurgency weapon, but also in connection with the Cambridge Analytica affair. So this is from the late spring of 1993.
Now, it was Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf that persuaded many of the top industrialists and financiers of Germany to back Hitler and the German Nazi Party, as opposed to some of the other conservative political parties that were in Germany at the time. This speech, the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, is, as I've said, it is not only very significant in terms of the evolution of German Nazism itself and the evolution of Adolf Hitler's political fortunes, it also has a larger significance, and I think it has a terrifyingly relevant perspective for those of us in 1993. It should be remembered that there are many in the corporate world, of course not all, I'm not even saying most, but many in the corporate world who will view the attitudes of Adolf Hitler with great favor and consequently will view democracy with disdain, fear, and contempt. For our discussion of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, we are going to turn to a book which I used in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast way back on May 23rd, 1980. This book is called Who Financed Hitler? Subtitled The Secret Funding of Hitler's Rise to Power, 1919 and 1933. It's authored by James Poole and Suzanne Poole, P-O-O-L. This book was published in both hardcover and softcover by the Dial Press and copyrighted 1979. Now again, the central feature of the pitch that Adolf Hitler gave before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, and it was a very successful pitch as well. It, as I said, it won over much of the industrial and financial elite of Germany, much of the corporate elite of Germany over to the Nazi Party. Hitler's pitch was that democracy itself is inherently subversive. As I said, the underlying premise was almost quasi-Calvinist or perhaps social Darwinist. It was Hitler's contention that what he called the politics of personality, the authority of personality, should be dominant rather than the democratic process. Again, he told the assembled industrialists and financiers that they were superior. They enjoyed their superior position in society because they had superior abilities, and that their superior position was a direct manifestation of their inherent superiority. And he maintained that democracy itself, disdained by some as the mob beast, that democracy itself was subversive because it allowed inferior people to wield political power and for their own benefit, and that this would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler went on to make a very explicit connection. He equated democracy with communism, and that is a viewpoint that unfortunately many of the world's industrialists and financiers, many of the world's corporate interests to this day maintain, and unfortunately that has been reflected in much of American foreign policy as it has been manifested since the end of the Second World War. The individual who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf was an individual who you heard described earlier in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. That's a fellow named Fritz Thyssen, capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, a German steelmaker. We discussed Thyssen not only in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May of 1980, but also in one of the addenda from June 14th of 1992. And it was Fritz Thyssen who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, the Poole's discussion of Hitler's speech here, to a large extent, speaks for itself, but bear in mind that the basic premise was a sort of quasi-Calvinist or social Darwinist view, which maintained that the industrialists and financiers, and bear in mind that in the Industry Club of Dusseldorf there were 600 of the most prominent of the German industrial and financial elite present, the contention of Hitler's was that they were inherently superior and that that is why they enjoyed their superior position in society, because they had superior abilities and those superior abilities manifested themselves in their superior position. He then said that democracy was bad because it allowed inferior people to wield power, and that ultimately those inferior people would restructure society for their own benefit, and that this would be counter-evolutionary. It would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler goes on to equate democracy with communism directly. And again, that's a viewpoint which is shared by a terrifyingly large section of the corporate elite, not only in this country, but of the world as a whole. I'm not maintaining that all of them feel that way, not even necessarily most, although one could argue perhaps that in terms of the ultimate manifestation of multinational corporate capitalism, it has worked out that way, but I will not make that contention. But we should note, as I have tried to point out in the past, that fascism is not something foreign to the United States, that many of the most prominent industrial and financial people, many of the most prominent elements of corporate society were openly pro-fascist and pro-Hitler in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and that they, to a large extent, have maintained that stance since in terms of the way they have governed not only the United States, but also much of the Third World as well. So Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, again, was not only significant because of its place in the historical rise of Hitler, its place in the history of the rise of German fascism, it has a larger historical and political and sociological significance as well, one which bears great significance for those of us here in the United States in May of 1993. The Pools write of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, bear in mind, this is 1931 when we're talking here. This is this might actually be the very beginning of 1932. I have always said that this was 1931. I may actually be wrong. I guess this was January 27th of 1932. So upon reading, I've always said this was 31. Actually, it was the very first month of 1932. So I will correct that error on the spot. Anyway, of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in January, specifically January 27th of 1932, the Pools write as follows. Now again, Thiessen is Baron Fritz Thiessen, a key German steel magnate. A few days later, Thiessen was in Berlin, where he claimed he met Hitler by accident. He mentioned the upcoming speech at the Industry Club, and Hitler replied, quote, "I think it would be better if I came myself," unquote. Thus, an announcement was sent to all the members that Herr Adolf Hitler would be the guest speaker of the Dusseldorf Industry Club. At 7 o'clock on the evening of January 27th, over 600 members of the Industry Club assembled in a large ballroom at the Park Hotel in Dusseldorf to hear Hitler's speech. The attendance was much larger than usual. It was the first opportunity many of the industrialists had had for getting a close view in their own familiar surroundings of a man about whom they had heard so much. These busy businessmen were not the type to run around to turbulent mass meetings. However, to attend an address organized by the club might prove to be both stimulating and interesting. The majority of those present were supporters of Gustav Stresemann's German People's Party, which was known for its pro-business attitude, or one of the other moderate, quote, bourgeois, unquote, parties. There were some with more reactionary opinions who were members of the German Nationalist Party, but with the exception of Fritz Thiessen and possibly a few others, there were no avowed National Socialists among the group. Quote, "The room was overcrowded," unquote, said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Dietrich is Dietrich. Resuming the text, by the way, Gustav Stresemann, Gustav, of course, Gustav, Stresemann, Stresemann. Beginning again this last paragraph, "The room," quote, "the room was overcrowded," said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Again quoting, "Huddled together sat the chief West German magnates, men in the public eye and those quiet but no less influential powers who, moving behind the scenes, control the fate of the economy by the soft sounds issuing from their private offices. Men said to bear a ledger rather than a heart." Joyful expectation brightened the faces of those already converted, but the vast majority bore an air of superiority and cool reserve, probably flattered that Hitler had approached them. Mere curiosity and general interest lured them to the meeting. They wanted to hear Hitler speak. They had no intention of being converted. They came to criticize, seeking confirmation of their own infallible opinion. The audience was surprised and even a bit affronted when at Hitler's approach they heard bullying voices in the entrance hall shouting, quote, "Alles aufstehen," everybody up. Some flabbergasted actually rose. Others made a gesture of rising in unwilling conformity and some remained seated. Hitler strode to the rostrum amid strong silence, followed by Fritz Thiessen, the chairman of the evening, and a score of SA men in their brown shirt uniforms, who took a position behind their Führer as a sort of stage backdrop. Hitler was wearing a rather ill-fitting cutaway coat and striped trousers, an attire in which he never looked quite comfortable. After a brief introduction by Fritz Thiessen, he received, quote, chilly, unquote, applause from the tightly packed audience. He was scheduled to speak for an hour and had requested that there be no smoking. Standing on a slightly raised platform, Hitler looked out at his audience and rested his hands lightly on an ornamental railing. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. I'm going to read this last paragraph again because it's a critical one. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. Quote, by the way, we should bear in mind before I continue that this book is being written in 1979. Of course, communism to a large extent is a thing of the past in 1993. Bolshevism, again quoting Hitler here, Bolshevism today is not merely a mob storming about in some of our streets in Germany, but it is a conception of the world which is in the act of subjecting to itself the entire Asiatic continent, and which today, in the form of a state, Russia, stretches almost from our eastern frontier to Vladivostok, reminiscent in some ways of the Evil Empire speech of Ronald Reagan. Continuing with Hitler's observations. The situation is represented as if here it was merely a question of purely theoretical problems, of views held by a few visionaries or evil-disposed individuals. No. A philosophy of life has won over to itself a state, and starting from this state, it will gradually shatter the whole world and bring it down in ruins. Bolshevism, if its advance is not interrupted, will transform the world as completely as in times past did Christianity. It is not as if this gigantic phenomenon could simply be thought away from the modern world. Unquote. Hitler argued, and this next paragraph is very important, the interpolative discussion by the Poles. Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Once again, Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Quote, you maintain, gentlemen, that German business life must be constructed on a basis of private property. Now, such a conception as that of private property can only be defended if in some way or another it appears to have a logical foundation. This conception must deduce its ethical justification from an insight into the necessity which nature dictates. By the way, nature has a capital N here. It cannot simply be upheld by saying, quote, it has always been so, and therefore it must continue to be so, unquote. For in periods of great upheaval, institutions and systems cannot remain untouched just because they have previously been preserved without change. It is the characteristic feature of all really great revolutionary epochs in the history of mankind that they pay astonishingly little regard for forms which are hallowed only by age. It is thus necessary to give sound foundations to traditional forms which are to be preserved so that they can be regarded as absolutely essential, as logical and right. Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree. I'm going to read these last couple of sentences again, because they're critical. Again, we're quoting Hitler here. Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree. It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement. Last couple of sentences again, or this last sentence again. It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement. Continuing with Hitler's speech, thus, it must be admitted that in the economic sphere, men are not of equal value or of equal importance. And once this is admitted, it is madness to say, in the economic sphere, there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore, in practice, on the authority of personality. But in the political sphere, to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy. Once again, last couple of sentences. And once this is admitted, it is madness to say in the economic sphere there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore in practice on the authority of personality, but in the political sphere to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy, unquote. Then the Pools go on to say, this statement illustrates one of Hitler's most effective arguments. It relates directly to the personal interest of the audience. By a strong logical development based on fallacious premises, Hitler was leading to the inescapable conclusion that the concept of private property would gradually be destroyed by democracy because democracy has as its ethical justification, its inner logic, the idea of human equality. If democracy continued to develop, it would gradually submerge the idea of private property, which was founded on a very different moral and ethical basis, the idea of individual differences and rewards allotted to talent. Interrupting here, the Pools' ruminations, these arguments are terrifyingly close to many arguments one will hear on the political right in the United States today. Continuing with the Pools' commentary, the whole edifice of civilization, Hitler continued, is, quote, the result of the creative capacity, the achievement, the intelligence, and the industry of individual God-favored geniuses, unquote. The men of average capacity are only a, quote, human labor force, unquote, which carry through the creations of genius and talent. One more time, this last couple of sentences. The whole edifice of civilization, Hitler continued, is, quote, the result of the creative capacity, the achievement, the intelligence, and the industry of individual God-favored geniuses, unquote. The men of average capacity are only a, quote, human labor force, unquote, which carry through the creations of genius and talent, quote. So it is only natural that when the capable intelligences of a nation, which are always in a minority, are regarded only as of the same value as all the rest, then genius, capacity, and the value of personality are slowly subjected to the majority, and this process is then falsely named the rule of the people. Last sentence again, quote, so it is only natural that when the capable intelligences of a nation, which are always in a minority, are regarded only as of the same value as all the rest, then genius, capacity, and the value of personality are slowly subjected to the majority, and this process is then falsely named the rule of the people. For this is not the rule of the people, but in reality the rule of stupidity, of mediocrity, of half-heartedness, of cowardice, of weakness, and of inadequacy. Rule of the people means rather that a people should allow itself to be governed and led by its most capable individuals, those who are born to the task, and not, quote, a chance majority which of necessity is alien to these tasks, unquote. By the way, we're going to hear as we go into the American support for Hitler's, for Mussolini's Italy, and we compare the economy under Reagan and Bush with Mussolini's corporate state, this basic rationalization here presented by Hitler was the rationalization behind the corporate state, and it led to the wholehearted support of fascism by many of the world's top industrialists and financiers. Repeating, rule of the people means rather that a people should allow itself to be governed and led by its most capable individuals, those who are born to the task and not, quote, a chance majority, which of necessity is alien to these tasks, unquote. Again, quoting now, and of course the person we're quoting here is Adolf Hitler, in periods of national decline, he said, we always find that in place of the value of personality, there is substituted a leveling idea of the supremacy of mere numbers, democracy, unquote. But now, again quoting, the concept of human equality itself has been developed into a political and economic, quote, system, unquote, and this system is communism. Last sentence again, because this is where Hitler directly equates democracy and communism. In periods of national decline, he said, we always find that in place of the value of personality, there is substituted a leveling idea of the supremacy of mere numbers, democracy, unquote. But now, again quoting, the concept of human equality itself has been developed into a political and economic system, and this system is communism. And again, continuing what Hitler said, in the last resort, political decisions are decisive, unquote, and determine the conduct in every sphere of national life. Again quoting, for 50 years, you can build up the best economic system on the basis of the principle of achievement. For 50 years, you may go on building factories. For 50 years, you may amass wealth, and then in 3 years of mistaken political decisions, you can destroy all the results of the work of these 50 years, unquote. There were murmurs of, quote, very true, unquote, and many members of the audience were nodding their heads in consent. Hitler had finally succeeded in breaking through the icy reserve of his audience. Again, quoting, to sum up the argument, he said, I see two diametrically opposed principles, the principle of democracy, which is the principle of destruction, and the principle of the authority of personality, which I would call the principle of achievement, because whatever man has achieved in the past, all human civilizations, is conceivable only if the supremacy of this principle is admitted, unquote. By associating his racist and elitist philosophy with the ideas of private property and individual initiative, Hitler had established a common interest with his audience. And again, to quote that very important last couple of sentences, to sum up the argument, he said, I see two diametrically opposed principles, the principle of democracy, which is the principle of destruction, and the principle of the authority of personality, which I would call the principle of achievement, because whatever man has achieved in the past, all human civilizations, is conceivable only if the supremacy of this principle is admitted, unquote. And the Pools go on to add, by associating his racist and elitist philosophy with the ideas of private property and individual initiative, Hitler had established a common interest with his audience. And again, it was this speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf on January 27, 1932, that Adolf Hitler won over much of the industrial and financial elite of Germany to supporting his German Nazi Party, as opposed to some of the other conservative political parties that were in existence at the time. And beyond its significance for the rise of German fascism, that speech is very significant because it provides an insight into a mentality which unfortunately has survived Adolf Hitler and which is very much with us today, which views democracy with suspicion and equates it with communism because it will allow inferior people to destroy the works of superior people. And it is that suspicion and disdain for democracy which holds the appeal of fascism for many of the top industrialists and financiers of the world. It held it for them in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and unfortunately it holds it for them today as well. And as we ruminate about and reflect on the principles enunciated by Hitler in that speech, we should bear in mind that these are principles which are endorsed by a terrifyingly large percentage of the industrial and financial elite of today as well.
That begins from the spring of 1993, and the book was Who Financed Hitler by James and Suzanne Poole. We are going to consider both the genesis of the Nazi Party itself and Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in connection with the Cambridge Analytica affair and the disruption of our democracy. However, that will be in our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 1076, Surveillance Valley Part 2, Mauthausen on Our Mind, being recorded on June 25th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.